Will AI ultimately make free market economics obsolete and destroy democracy in favor of digital dictatorships? We continue on our third installment talking about what some credentialed futurists think. That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. Will Infotech and Biotech erode human agency, subvert human desires, and render free market economics obsolete? We're continuing in the third installment of a conversation with Dr. Jay Richards, and I would encourage you, if you haven't, to go listen to the first two episodes so that you can have a firmer foundation for the topics that we're going to be talking about now. We're talking about a paper, an article, if you will, written by Yuval Noah Harari in The Atlantic concerning the destruction of democracy by AI in the future. Our guest is Dr. Jay Richards, and we introduced him on the first program, even though, as we said on the second program, he's a man that needs no introduction. So we will skip over the introduction and go straight to the points. What I've been doing is reading some of the quotes from Harari's paper, his article, and kind of discussing them with Dr. Richards. So let's go on with the next quote. Okay, quote, in the late 20th century, democracies usually outperformed dictatorships because they were better in processing information. We tend to think about the conflict between democracy and dictatorship as a conflict between two different ethical systems, but it is actually a conflict between two different data processing systems.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's a very sort of odd argument, I think. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I do think that the more technologically advanced a society is, the more capable a dictatorship can become. So certainly the kind of surveillance state that you could have now can be much more intrusive than what was possible, say, in the 17th century, in which the king, no matter how dictatorial he is, only has so much access and so much reach. But that's actually not what Harari is talking about. I mean, he seems to think that somehow if we're going to have such sophisticated AIs, that these AIs can actually, I don't know, plan and control an economy. But no matter how fast a computer is calculating things, it's not going to have direct access to people's economic judgments and economic values at any particular moment. And so the same basic economic problem that limited socialist planning in the 20th century, none of that's going to change in the 21st century. And I don't care how fast the computers are at calculating, they're still not going to do that. So if somebody thinks, oh, now in this new technocracy, we can, sort of install some elites with really sophisticated computers, and they can plan economies, they can put prices on everything, they can determine what production quotas are, Well, they might try that, and they will discover just what Vladimir Lenin discovered in the early 20th century, which is that it completely destroys an economy very quickly. And so I don't think there's anything about high technology that's going to change the basic rules of economics and the role of signaling and prices or supply and demand. All those things are still here.
Again, I'm trying to jump the chasm between his comments and the consequences that he claims. Could it be by better at processing information, he means things such as gathering intelligence? Hmm. I think, for example, of the invention of the airplane at the end of World War I. There could be no longer movements behind the lines, secret movements and maneuvers by the enemy in order to put themselves in a position to attack you. The airplane totally did away with that. I'm thinking of radar. All of a sudden, we had radar and technology, and that allowed us to be superior to the Nazis.
That's right.
And you know, a story I heard, this is very interesting. The Nazis were under the impression that something magical was happening because their airplanes were being shot down in the fog and cloudy days. And they wonder what the heck was happening. So the Allies release a piece of propaganda that says the Allied pilots were actually eating carrots. And that's where the idea that carrots were good for your eyes came from.
Interesting. Yeah, that it is funny. And I mean, but I think honestly, if we take that sort of line, it's that The truth is exactly the opposite. I mean, if you look at where technological innovation actually takes place, it mostly takes place in free societies in which different groups of people and different firms can try different things. I mean, you look at, China. Everyone talks about China as an economic powerhouse, and it is, but in part, that's because it was coming from basically a very primitive agrarian economy, and it's moved into the industrial economy. But look at where most of the great inventions still happen. They still tend to happen in countries with limited government, with patent systems and things like that. And so I don't think there's any reason to think that somehow technology is going to favor dictatorship in any obvious sense.
Yeah, this seemed to be, I have no idea what he means by this. This is, I think in the first broadcast, I read a sentence and you said, I have no idea what he's talking about. I kind of have no idea what he's talking about. I try to give him the benefit of the doubt and make this jump maybe to radar and intelligence and stuff of that sort, but I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
I think that what you're doing is you're providing some things that make his argument better, but I don't actually think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying something quite different. And I do think really to get this essay that Harari has in The Atlantic, it helps to have some background exposure to his previous book. So you sort of see where he's coming from on this.
I see. I also noticed nowhere he doesn't say why the data process or information processing allowed democracies to outperform dictatorships.
No, he doesn't. And so, yeah, I mean, because the best argument I can think of for that would be that, well, we got a jump on technology. And so we were able to win, in World War II and things like that. But nothing like, he doesn't say anything like that.
Okay. Roman numeral 4 in Harari's paper is the transfer of authority to machines. Now, I read this, and you know who I immediately thought of? HAL 9000 in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Okay, here's the quote. But once we begin to count on AI to decide what to study, where to work, and whom to date or even marry, human life will cease to be a drama of decision-making, and our conception of life will need to change. Democratic elections and free markets might cease to make sense. So might most religions and works of art.
This is one of the more obscure statements, I think, in the piece, but I do think that it starts to make sense if you, as he does, imagine that AI actually are going to become sort of super intelligent, conscious agents. If we're just talking about the artificial intelligence we experience, I mean, let's use eHarmony, for instance, eHarmony.com. People are using a more and more sophisticated kind of search mechanism to meet mates. My friend that wrote The Privileged Planet with me, Guillermo Gonzalez, met his wife through eHarmony. And so in a sense, people are using a type of AI to help them make decisions about even who to marry. But again, this is an aid in helping them to make decisions. The AI is not making the decision for them. And if you think about it, I mean, how is this not better than some of the, a lot of people used to meet who they married in bars? I would say actually using something like eHarmony, that's a vast improvement, that we're not losing our agency to that. We're actually finding a way to actually sift through all the complex data. Because I think if anything, we still have limited time and limited attention span and limited, capacity for attention. And so I think we're going to need these tools as the proliferation of information continues to accumulate. I think, honestly, this argument only makes sense if you assume that AIs aren't glorified Googles, which is what I think that they're going to be, but rather that they're going to be these sentient, conscious super intelligences that we can actually hand everything over to, even elections and markets.
One of the things I don't get is the assumption that we would actually surrender our decisions to a computer. I'm not going to surrender my decision to a computer of where my kids are to study or where I'm to work or who I'm to date or who I'm to marry. I'm not going to surrender it to that. But there's this assumption, which I think is actually ludicrous.
It is. And I find it funny, honestly. I mean, I live right here in the middle of Washington, D.C. In fact, I'm 3 miles north of the the Capitol. Trust me, as long as there are ambitious people, they're not going to be surrendering any of their decisions to
That's
machines.
That's a good point. The politicians are the obvious anti-example, yeah. Right? One of the troubling things here is that all this proliferation of AI, it might make religions obsolete. I know you're a Christian. I'm a Christian. Yes. As a person of faith, I don't understand this statement at all. Why would this proliferation of AI make people have religion and consider it obsolete?
I think, again, this is Harari's own thinking. So Harari was raised by secularists. He himself is a committed secularist. If you look at what he says about religion, he thinks religion is essentially about relieving anxiety. And so if we have drugs and machines that relieve, you know, kind of chemical anxiety problems, he thinks religion will be obsolete. But again, he's not really getting this. Look, if you're a Christian, you think it's true. You think it explains reality. And so that's not going to change because you have some kind of fancy computer. But again, he has such a reductionist understanding of religion that he just assumes, well, I mean, it's just a sort of opiate for the masses. And once we've got a better high-tech opiate from biotechnology, nobody's going to need it. I think that's the only thing I can imagine that he has in mind. What I would actually see happening is that the human skills actually are going to become more valuable. So, you know, if you're, say, a physician and you don't have to deal with all the complicated issues having to do with diagnosis because you have a sophisticated Watson program that can determine the diagnosis, then your valuable skill is going to be your bedside manner in bringing the news to people that they have cancer and things like that. And so I would expect ministry and evangelism and the kinds of things that involve human interaction. I think if anything, there's going to be a premium on those kinds of skills. I don't think there are any chance of them becoming obsolete.
My reaction to his statement was shallowness. Again, he's making an assumption looking at religion from 5,000 miles away and really not getting into the depths and the understanding of what, for example, Christianity is all about.
That's exactly right.
Yes. He goes on, he says, he poses all of these problems. Harari poses all these problems. And then he says, so what shall we do? He said, for starters, we need to place a much higher priority on understanding how the human mind works.
That sounds great to me. Yes, absolutely. What's funny, though, is that if you read his books, he seems to already think he knows how the human mind works. And basically, it's exactly the same as the computers. And so I'm all for that. The question is going to be, that's going to require an understanding or at least a kind of philosophical stance that is appropriate to the thing being studied. If you decided ahead of time that human beings and the human mind are just computers made of meat, we're just machines made of meat, there's nothing you can discover. What you want to do is say, okay, let's position ourselves intellectually to find out what human beings are actually like. And if he would do that, I'd love to join in and doing it. What we don't want is a kind of pre-existing materialism that decides the question ahead of time. Because I think if people just engage in a little introspection about your own experience of yourself, you can realize that you're not actually a machine. I think Harari, in fact, knows that despite himself. But nevertheless, he's adopted this view of human beings that would reduce us to machines.
My reaction in looking at this was a recollection of propositional logic where the false implies true statement is altogether true. So I agree with the consequent. Let's study the human mind. But the other side of the implication, to solve the problem of AI, we need to look at the mind. I don't think that that's the top way to actually address the challenges that he addresses and that I believe are coming in AI.
Yes. So I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. I mean, we're making machines that are doing amazing things, but don't mistake them for what we're doing and what's happening inside our minds. And the truth of the matter is we have a much better sense of our capacities and the fact that we are agents who experience freedom and choice than we have a sense of how exactly it works. That may forever be one of the deepest mysteries.
Absolutely. Okay, next quote. Quote, if we want to prevent the concentration of all wealth and power in the hands of a small elite, we must regulate the ownership of data. Then he goes on later and says, nationalism of data by governments could offer one solution. What do you think?
Well, I mean, so concentration of wealth and power is a bad thing. So therefore, let's concentrate it more as a solution.
Boy, bingo, but, yeah.
You know, and I mean, this happens a lot. You often see this among economic progressives is that, well, you've got a few rich guys that are holding all the power. Therefore, let's tax it all away and give it to the people that own the guns and the tanks, right? I mean, the argument's very strange. I think Harari himself sort of realizes, okay, well, that's probably maybe not a great idea if we look at what happened with governments in the 20th century. Nevertheless, he says it's one sort of possibility, and he does then go on to talk about ownership of data and does it, you know, my impression is he does have something like, well, what we want is a collective ownership of data rather than corporate ownership of data. And I suspect that by collective, he ends up meaning, well, the government owns it on behalf of us. And so if anything, if you're worried about the over-concentration of power and wealth, you don't want to increase that power in the hands of the state. That should be plain to everyone.
What do you think the relationship between George Gilder's new book on After Google has with this claim?
Well, what's funny is if you read Gilder's book, he actually thinks that this economy that is developed by, it's really Facebook and Google are the paradigm examples of a kind of a free economy in which we get goods or services really, and it seems like it's for free. So the search that you do on Google, you're not getting charged for it. You don't get charged to set up a Facebook account. And so that part of it is free, but any economist will tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch. So how exactly do they succeed? Well, they succeed actually by getting information, by getting data on your choices. So Google gets information on your searches, and then they use that to drive this revenue model. And Gilder actually thinks this is a highly unstable model because it's not secure. And in fact, there's constantly security problems. And so he actually thinks that this kind of this free economy is quickly going to get displaced or at least disrupted by the emergence of blockchain technology that's actually going to allow all sorts of peer-to-peer interactions that will make this particular way of operating obsolete. And so Gilder's vision, anyone that's read Life After Google that then goes and reads Harari's stuff, I think they will be mostly inoculated to this stuff. And then Gilder, of course, is not at all enamored by these fanciful claims about strong artificial intelligence. I mean, George Gilder, on the one hand, I think Wikipedia accuses him of being a techno-utopian, but in fact, he knows perfectly well that we're not going to gain immortality or our salvation for technology. We may improve the human condition, and it may allow us to do lots of things and create value that we couldn't create before, but it's not ultimately going to save us nor displace us unless we let it do so, unless we let it replace us or displace us.
Excellent. And thank you for correcting me. I think I said the name of the book was Beyond Google, but you mentioned that the name of George Gilder's new book is Life After Google. I have listened to it, and I recommend it highly. I think it's very insightful with lots of good ideas.
Definitely.
Okay, another quote. This returns to a topic that we've already kind of talked about, and it uses a terrible term of ordinary people, smacking of elitism. Ordinary people will find it very difficult. I don't know, Jay, are you ordinary?
I don't know. I don't know if I count in that category.
I don't know. Sometimes it depends on the time of the day. Sometimes I think I'm ordinary. Ordinary people will find it very difficult to resist this process of AI generating advertising.
Well, it sounds like high-tech elites are not susceptible to clever advertising, whereas I can tell you I don't buy it. I mean, in fact, if anything, they're more susceptible to these things. In fact, it's often elites that are willing to do fashionable things just for the sake of being seen to do it. I wonder, who's he thinking of with these ordinary people? I guess he's thinking of, I don't know, people that just get their coffee at Dairy Queen or something rather than Starbucks.
Yeah, poor ordinary people. Well, let me take a poke from the other side. Certainly, Goebbels, who was a propaganda minister for Nazis, said that you had to hit people with bad propaganda, even false propaganda, again and again and again and again, and ultimately they would believe it. Could this be a precursor of what Harari is talking about?
I think that that's where I would have expected his argument to go, and I think that that is a problem. I think we do need to worry about the use of a sort of absolute political authority to use technology to manipulate us in a much subtler and more sophisticated way. And so, I think if you want to sort of worry about the future, don't spend so much time in 1984. Spend more time in Brave New World. I know when my daughter read both of these books, her junior year in high school, she was more creeped out by Brave New World because she thought rather than having this kind of Stalinist dictatorship, what we will have is we could have a state that sort of pleases us and fulfills our sort of basest fantasies and gives us drugs that allow us to feel good. And so then controls us in that way. I think that's a genuine worry. Any kind of advance in technology
extends our power, and it extends our power for good and for ill. And so I think that's an honest danger. I think we should sort of face that squarely. On the other hand, technology also enhances the power of people. So just as the state might want to do something bad, ordinary people and ordinary citizens also have access to the internet. So it's just like a cop that tries to do something bad now is much more likely to have it videoed and put on YouTube. And so I honestly think technology is almost always a mixed bag. It's something that whether it's good or bad depends very much on what we decide to do with it. And I think that's true in this case as in any.
Excellent. Yeah. I think, again, it's pure elitism. And of course, there's always going to be the pressure of advertising, political campaigns and such. But for some incredible reason, those that are free and live in liberty are able to resist that, I think, a lot easier than most. Okay, I'm going to end with the last quote from the book, and then I'd like you to comment on that, and then maybe your summary of what you think Harari's paper is about. The last quote is, oh gosh, this is hard to read. Currently, humans risk becoming similar to domesticated animals.
Again, I don't know why he's saying this, but I think, again, he's imagining that what we're going to have is these super intelligent AIs, and we're going to be so inferior to them that we're going to have to serve them. Because, of course, domesticated animals, they don't exercise the kind of freedom that we do. They sort of, I've got a domesticated cat here, and he relies on me for absolutely everything. Now, in the sense that we can become more and more dependent upon our technology, okay, yeah, he has sort of a point. But this idea that we're going to become dependent in the sense that we're actually being directed by these super beings, which he believes, he thinks that's what's going to happen, I think that's based entirely upon his sort of fanciful read of where this technology is going. I think if anything, if you think about information technology and focus on that word information, at least the kind of robust information that is involved in a written text or a sculpture or software programming, that's something that's the unique jurisdiction of intelligent agents. And so rather than thinking that an information economy is going to be one that's inhumane or that's going to leave us behind, I think if anything, it's one that's uniquely fit for human beings who are the unique creators and sources of new information. So, and you know, somebody could say, well, that's based upon your kind of anthropological assumptions and what you believe is true about human beings and God. But my argument is, look, let's use these assumptions then to make predictions about the future and see who's more right than wrong when these things actually work their way out.
Excellent. Any final thoughts or summary about Harari's article?
I would say keep a watch on him for listeners that may, you know, really be into this stuff. They might not find the argument all that persuasive, but I think the fact that he went from a fairly unknown character, say even in 2010, an academic in Israel, to an international best-selling author who's, I suspect, will have a PBS series before long.
or maybe Netflix, right?
Yes, or Netflix, yeah, exactly, even better, Netflix, that he will, he's a really good representative of this kind of materialist trajectory that is, it's very much a part of the discussion in artificial intelligence, and it's also the trajectory that we're trying to critique and to create an alternative to at the Bradley Center.
Exactly. Excellent. Well, thank you, Jay. By the way, we're talking about a article written by Yuval Noah Harari, which is published in The Atlantic. We'll provide a link to that. Jay, could you say something about The Atlantic? I looked at some of their articles, and they seem to be politically very liberal.
Yeah, they're mostly politically to the left, but it's not a left-wing publication like The Nation or The Guardian. They have known and been around for decades, but they're known for publishing these long thought essays like this. And so actually, in my book, The Human Advantage, I often quote from The Atlantic because in some ways, they are articles in The Atlantic more often than not are a perfect distillation of the kind of elite consensus, conventional wisdom on a particular topic. And certainly this piece by Harari is an example of that.
Exactly. Well, Jay Richards, thank you very much. Our guest has been Jay Richards. He's has a professor position in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America, and is also the executive editor of The Stream, which is at thestream.org. So if you want to follow up on Jay and some of the things that he's doing, also go to Amazon, look at his books, especially his most recent book, which I have listened to. And let's see if I have the name of that, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Jay, thank you again.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so for Mind Matters, until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.today. That's mindmatters.today. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.